On today's show, we talk with DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid. They've won Best DJs in Portland in the Willamette Week's Best of Portland Readers Poll 2016, and are the resident DJs of Andaz, the West Coast's longest-running Bhangra and Bollywood dance party. They were a fun interview, so let's get the show rolling. I don't know if any of you have ever been to one of their dance nights, but it gets pretty crazy on the dance floor when they're playing their music. I mean, you got people contorting their bodies in ways that I have not seen since I was a 14-year-old boy reading a Kama Sutra book. Regardless, they do a great night. It's fun, it's happening, it's hopping. And that has not changed for many, many years, well over a decade. So without further ado, it's myself and DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid today on pdxpodcast.com.
I'm Steven Strasbaugh. I go by The Incredible Kid.
I'm DJ Anjali. My full name's Gitanjali, but I go by Anjali. Yeah. Been in Portland doing my thing since 2000.
Since 2000, wow.
That's a long time. Well, okay, so I was born here, grew up here, but doing my DJ thing since 2000, I should say.
And how did it begin? How did this adventure begin?
It was a bathroom break. So we both worked at Powell's City of Books downtown, and at the time we were unionizing the bookstore. We were both involved with the unionization effort. This was around 2000. And there was a woman named Tricia Schultz who was one of the organizers working on getting the bargaining unit together, and she was having a birthday party and invited me to DJ because I was DJing different house parties and stuff around that time. I'd gotten my start in Eugene on college radio KWVA back in 1995, and then had been doing just kind of DJing house parties really low key. And then end of 2000, I got invited to do this party. I was like, yeah, sure. And Anjali said, hey, at work, you know, I'd like to learn how to DJ at some point. And I believe
she didn't know how to DJ.
No. Oh. Or she thought she didn't. And so she, you know, she knew that I was doing it, wasn't impressed at all, and thought, well, but maybe he'd teach me some basics so I can do a lot better job. And I believe in learning on the job. So I called her. So I called her up and said, how about, you know, come down and do this party on Saturday? So she showed up, and I'd been playing kind of the early part of the night for a while. And I was like, oh, can you take over while I go to the bathroom? And she's like, oh, yeah, sure. Starts putting on some Britpop. And I come back from the bathroom to see this crazy dance party that was not there at all a few minutes prior. And I realized, I think she's got something here. And so that's how it started.
Really? Was there a romance brooding at that point?
Yes, definitely. As the kid said, we both worked at Powell's like mid-90s, and I was obsessed with Britpop, and that was kind of my thing. And we were organizing Powell's, and there were all these house parties that went along with the organizing. And it was Steven and a couple other dudes at Powell's. It was the same three boys, like, at every party. And I was pretty annoyed, like, hey, I think I could do that. It didn't look that hard. I mean, you know, you're just playing some songs. right? I mean, you're pretty much just putting on some records and some CDs. That's how we did it back then. That's how I did it. Actually, the kid was all vinyl at that point. One day at work, I was like, hey, can you show me how? I didn't have access to DJ equipment. I didn't know how you went about getting gigs. But I was like, oh, you're a DJ, like, show me how to do that thing. And then at this party, yeah, literally I just, like, brought a bag of records and CDs. And what he and the other dudes I saw were playing were very different from my interests. So I think that was the thing. Like, people responded to the different sounds that I brought, whether it was, like, Asian Underground or Britpop or even just, I don't know, old Bollywood song or old French pop song. It's just very different from anything I saw anybody else do. And I never thought it would become anything. I just thought it was fun because I had weird music and music that I wanted to share. And I love to dance. That's the other thing. Like, I also think it's weird sometimes that most DJs are men. And it's such, to me, it's such a, like, physical thing to play music for people. Mm-hmm. Like, if I don't feel it, then I can't really, like, share it with people. And so usually it is kind of like, there's like the stereotype of the dude who's a record collector, but like, right, the music is supposed to make people dance, and like, I know how to dance. Yeah. So I feel like, okay, I have this thing that I can share with people. Not that, and so the kids, I mean, he's not a bad DJ. It's just that, like, I just have it. No, I just have a different, I have a different approach.
He's not bad. He's not bad.
I just have a different approach. And it, yeah.
And the music.
In fact, he's a way more technical DJ than I am. I feel the music differently, so.
and what you played evolved, right? I mean, you're playing Britpop and...
Well, at the time, I was playing a total mix of music, everything from hip-hop to funk, old soul and R&B, but also 80s and just, you know, girl punk and international stuff and just a whole grab bag of anything that had ever moved me and I thought might move other people. Yeah. And I thought I was always going to be the DJ that played everything and never thought I would become a genre-based DJ. And then she played the first Bunger track I ever heard, and I was like, whoa, what is this? And so then she got me buying Bunger and Bollywood music, which I'd never found at the standard record stores, and she introduced me to the fact that you got to go to the Indian stores to buy it. And at the time, I was all vinyl, and she introduced me to the fact like you can get it on CD and you can get it on cassette, but it's been decades since it's been available on vinyl. So I started buying this stuff and taking it home and listening to it and going, oh, I could probably play this all night. And it just... You know, it entered as kind of a sound that we were, you know, part of our sound, and then it just kind of took over.
It became Ondas?
That there were a few steps. There were a few steps in there. We'd played different mixed gigs at different clubs, and by mixed gigs, I mean we were playing Indian stuff, but we were also playing a mix of other sounds. And then more and more, we sensed this hunger from a certain aspect of the crowd. It's like we just want to hear Indian stuff, South Asian stuff all night. And so finally, we were in touch with Jimmy Byron, who was booking the Crystal Ballroom at the time, and he said, you know, yeah, let's do a night at Lola's Room, because the Willamette Week had written a little thing about us, because we were playing at a club called the Blackbird at the time, and so we got a little article, and, you know, the Crystal Ballroom's like, yeah, let's do something, and that was Ondas, and that was July of 2002, and it was a huge success, and so we did another one at Lola's Room before moving to the Fez, and then just recently celebrated 14 years of that party at its, like, fourth or fifth venue now, so.
Yeah. Very long-running DJ pair, you two. And you had a very long run at Holocene, too.
We did. We played there for almost 10 years. After we started on Ondas, we had all these other musical interests that didn't fit into the South Asian category. Well, and some of the music we wanted to play in the South Asian category was much more electronic. So that's when we teamed up with E3 and created Atlas. And we had like a 10-month run at Holocene with that party.
That's and almost unprecedented for a dance club night.
Mm-hmm. It was before, you know, before Global Bass was a term, but that's essentially what that party was. We played French hip-hop and Shabi from Egypt and Asian Underground from the UK and pretty much whatever we wanted. It was, the genre list was endless.
And you've done a lot of tours outside of Portland, too, New York City, big cities, small cities, right?
Yeah.
We do a handful of things like that. We don't do a lot of things. What we've learned is that, counterintuitive as it is, the DJ business is all about having original music. So as DJs that don't have original music, we're super limited because everybody wants you to have your 12-inch or have your debut album or whatever. And even though you would think DJing, it's about playing other people's music, but the industry is based around DJs who have their own music. So as a result, we do get, you know, flown out to do weird little tiny towns. We do get flown out to do places like New York City or LA, but we're way more based in the Pacific Northwest. Not necessarily by choice, but that's just how the industry works. So,
well, we do play kind of the Desi party circuit a little bit, which you don't necessarily have to have original music. And I think we almost get booked as an oddity, you know? Like we play Basement Bhangra in New York or Bhangra Tech in Chicago or we play NSB, Nonstop Bhangra in San Francisco. We play that party every year. And it's... I don't know, it's like almost like, hey, look at these weird kids from Portland. Like, they throw Desi parties, at least I have like a little bit of a alternative approach to it. Like, it's almost like they're booking like that weird couple from Portland. but we play in Vancouver, BC more than we play SF or Seattle, actually. Yeah, they love us up there. Because there's such a large Punjabi community there, you know, in Surrey and... In BC, it's fun. I mean, they they actually listen to Bhangra there. You know, like a lot of Bhangra singers are actually from Surrey and outside of Vancouver, BC. So it's like a homegrown kind of Northwest Bhangra scene there. Yeah, it's cool.
Now, what is the homegrown Northwest Bhangra scene? How can you characterize that?
Well, we actually used to have like Punjabi immigrants here in Oregon and in Washington. No, 80 years ago, maybe not 80 years ago. Yeah, actually 100 years ago, as kind of part of the Commonwealth, you know, like Punjabi laborers came to California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, but they couldn't own property in the States. So that's why a lot of them ended up in Canada, because they could actually own their own farms there. Which is why, I mean, yeah, there are South Asians here, but most of the South Asians kind of came back later to work at Intel, you know what I mean? Right. But yeah, in Surrey, if you go, it's just endless strip malls of Punjabi stores. They've got their own, like, Khalsa credit unions, and they have their own trucking schools and sweet shops and clothing stores. I mean, it's like a full, it's like they took Punjab and they set it down in Surrey, British Columbia. It's crazy. And yeah, so many singers there, musicians, and the big ones like Jazzy B, you know, they move back to India and they're international pop stars. But it's like Bhangra is no big deal there. It's like you're into Bhangra like we all are. You know, it's not like here. It's very, very common.
Yeah. Now, you do play shows in Vancouver quite often. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a great festival that we've done a few times called Vancouver International Bhangra Celebration, VIBC. That's a lot of fun. It's a totally unique and very forward-thinking festival within the scene. And like, you know, we played the Vancouver Art Gallery up there recently. We did the Indian Summer Festival recently. There's a lot of cool events up there, and they're open to doing things different. So,
do you see your influence in the music scene here in Portland? It's written that you do have, I mean, this huge sort of influence on music here in the Northwest. Do you sense that, or is that
where is this written?
You guys are laughing.
Where is this written?
I read it somewhere. I did some Googling.
Somewhere I read it. A huge influence.
No, you got a lot of great press, and I you know what I think? I read that in your bio.
Oh, did we make up something and put it in our bio?
We wouldn't do that.
There are certainly things that we brought to this city that didn't exist before.
Maybe that's what we meant, yeah. There are a lot of visiting artists that would never play Portland except that we hosted them.
I see. Okay.
Like back in the day, we brought Sub Swara played Portland for the first time at our party. We brought State of Bengal twice. Yeah, I'm probably drawing a blank, but we've hosted so many artists.
Twice selected Chief Boyma, Matt Shade Tech. We're about to bring Bumback Joe. Oh, we brought Raphael Dandy. For his debut. We brought
Dandy.
Upper Dandy
okay.
for his debut. So,
Quarry.
Well,
I mean, these are, yeah.
But we're not even, I mean, the joke is there are definitely different artists, producers, DJs that have come through town that we've hosted, but that's not our focus at all. Like, our focus has always been, like, we're just the resident DJs. Mm-hmm. If we have opportunities to bring people, we do. That is a minor part of what we do, though. Like, most of what we do is just show up and play. And so, in terms of the influence, it's more that, you know, there wasn't reggaeton being played in mainstream clubs before I showed up and started playing it. Like, there are different sounds that we would introduce. And I don't know that anyone picked up the torch, but it's more that there wouldn't have been a scene if we hadn't said, we want to start playing this music.
Right. I know you're creating a scene with these two shows that you have.
It's definitely like an outlet for people who love the music. And that's kind of how it started out. And then over the years, it's become a space not just for people who love the music, but also for like young brown kids who grow up with Bhangra, or maybe grow up like listening to cumbia. They come to our parties, and it's like a space for people to connect with each other and feel like they're represented somewhere, you know, in this little town. So,
and you know, you're on KBOO and X-Ray, mm-hmm. two shows a week. How is that, like, really stressful? You gonna do all this work?
I feel like it's good incentive for us,
yes.
actually. I also think it's kind of part of our anti-capitalist, like, giving back to the community, you know, because we charge money to for our parties, and we're not really, you know, we're not into, like, making money off of doing this, and so it's part of us, like, okay, if you can't come to our shows because you're not 21 or clubbing's not your thing or you don't want to be around alcohol, like, you can still tune in and hear us on the radio. It's like our version of volunteering, you know? It's like...
This might be the problem, is that we're not trying to make money off of this, but it's the only way we make money, so this might explain some of our difficulties in this world. But yeah, no, I mean, in terms of any sort of influence, I would say it would be more like people being like, well, we're definitely not going to do what they do, and we're not going to be anything like them. Like, it could be influence in terms of, oh, those freaks, like... Ignore anything they do and don't touch them with a 10-foot pole. Like, yeah, we definitely haven't felt like, you know, people have been influenced in the sense of, like, oh, we want to do what they do. But there certainly have been people in the scene that have told us, like, oh, we decided to do something very, very different because we saw you guys were doing something very different and it was working for you. And so, you know, not that we're going to pick up on your sound or your style or whatever, but we're inspired to try something that might be crazy, you know.
I think it's really cool... that when we started doing this, I mean, this whole time, it's been me also exploring my identity and kind of trying to figure that thing out. And when we first started out, like, South Asians didn't really support us. And now our parties definitely, like, draw a lot of Desi diaspora kids. And it's cool to hear from them, like, that they support what I do. And it's, like, for them, it's important that I'm out there. Right. Like, that's sweet, you know?
And you also teach classes, mm-hmm. too. Right. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I've kind of been a dancer off and on since I was in high school. And believe it or not, like, I have been very shy, like, most of my life. So people wanted me to teach dance for a long time, and I really, really didn't want to. And then a few years ago, I just turned a leaf, I guess, and decided I really need to get over myself because, I don't know, what was the option? Like, going to Zumba and learning Bhangra there? Like, that's a pretty shitty option, right? Like, so for me, it was like, okay, I kind of need to, I don't know, up my game, like, take responsibility for... sharing my culture, even though I'm not Punjabi. It's not like I didn't grow up with Bhangra, but through playing all these parties all over North America and all the Punjabis that come to our party, like, I've learned so much Bhangra just by throwing these parties. I felt like, okay, I can share my knowledge with people that want to. It just, there's just some, you know, there's like I said, like, the Zumba, Bollywood, Bhangra, like, that shit just, like, really irks me. And so I felt like I need to put out my own version that I feels, like, a little bit more substantial and, like, and based.
How, yeah. Yeah, and how would you describe that? How would you describe your own version?
Oh, that's a really good question. So Bhangra is traditionally, like, a men's harvest dance, and it's not traditionally done by women, but it's kind of, like, you know, the tides are changing, like, more and more young women are stepping into the Bhangra role. Actually, I just danced at a Punjabi wedding last night with, like, five of my dancer girls. And it's interesting because in some families, they're so conservative. They're just kind of like, oh, Indian girls doing Bhangra. I don't know about this. You know, I mean, you know, obviously I can't read their minds, but you can kind of see the look on their faces. Yeah. And I know that we've done Punjabi family functions where the room is segregated, like, all the men are on one side doing Bhangra and all the women are on one side, and they're not doing Bhangra, they're doing, like, kind of the more genteel, like, give the ladies version. And I love to go dance, like, I just love to jump out and dance with people, and I'll ask the women, like, do you guys ever Bhangra? And they're just like, no. Like, it's not very ladylike, you know? Yes. Yeah, in some families, it's kind of frowned upon, I guess. Yeah. But so my version's kind of like, how would I describe it? I don't know. It's like a little hip-hoppy, and it's like taking the traditional moves but kind of putting a little bit of my spin on it because I studied classical Indian dance. I have a little bit of that kind of thrown in there, too.
Oh, really?
My mom was a classical dancer in India, and when we when I was a kid here in Oregon, she would like dance at the Indian functions, you know.
So a bit of traditional dance in there too.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So it's a little bit, yeah, a little bit of classical on top of the folk and the hip hop.
So you guys work together, you live together. Are you ever apart? You ever get sick of each other?
Oh yeah.
Get the hell out of my face.
Are you kidding?
That's why there's a main kid.
How is it possible that someone could like be business partners, life partners, creative partners, romantic partners, all those things, and not have there be tension and difficulty? And we have to have a business meeting. Yeah, but I need a little bit of space. Yeah, no, there's
absolutely.
They're absolutely. Yeah, that's how we survive. There are absolutely challenges. But we made it work all this time, so.
No, I know a director, Brett Eichenberger. He works with his wife. He's done it for well over a decade. They write together, they produce together, direct together. It works. It works. It can work.
No comment.
I'm actually, that name sounds so familiar. I'm like, I think I worked with Brett decades ago. Huh, interesting. I haven't heard that name in a while.
Portland is very small and very connected. I like to do the show just to hear all the comments about, oh, I know that guy. I know that guy who knows some guy.
But I also think one of the things about Portland is how disconnected it is, in the sense that as long as I've been here, and I moved here in 83, there'll be all these little different scenes going on that are usually completely unaware of each other. So as much as we've been doing what we've been doing as long as we have, with the success that we have, there are plenty of people in Portland that have never heard of us, and plenty of people that have never come to see us. And for every little type of scene, whether it's an electro noise scene or an experimental comedy night, or you know, whether it's a musical thing or an art thing or whatever, they're going to be, the majority of people in the city, they're totally unaware of it. And so there are links between scenes, but then there are also scenes that maybe would be very fertile interacting that are completely unaware of each other.
But well, we just played LA earlier this year, and there are all these like South Asian women that knew each other online but had never actually met, and came together for this show that I put together. And they're like, oh, yeah, like half of us don't have cars. It's like an hour and a half to, you know, meet somebody. I feel like we are super connected here because, like, geographically the town is tinier. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And, like, literally in L.A., like, all these women, they're like, oh, like, I follow you on Instagram. Never met you. Live in the same town. And here they are, like, for the first time meeting at the show we did. So it's interesting.
You've been doing this for so long. You must have seen relationships develop. Is that right? I mean, your music brings people together.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing this for so long that if you were 5 years old when we started professionally, you can now come out to our 21 and overnights. And so, yeah, it's one of the challenges of what we do is we're getting to the point where we've been doing this almost as long as the age of some of the people that are showing up. And you're constantly trying to relate to a younger and younger generation, because we've, you know, totally had people that started seeing us when we started who then domesticated and had kids and are now like very rarely coming out to the clubs. And then you're left like, oh, I got to try to appeal to a whole new generation that's now at the point where they're starting to come out to the clubs.
Well, the funniest thing I've heard from a couple of ladies recently, they're like, oh, my mom loves you. I'm like, oh, you're 22 and your mom used to come see us like 16 years ago. Cool. It's a thing. It's really funny. Hopefully I...
Your laugh sounds just like your sister.
You know my
exactly,
sister?
Exactly,
yes.
Holy shit. Portland, yeah. Do you have any interest in any of the scenes going on in Portland? There's a big comedy scene, like you said. It's sort of an experimental scene, too. Experimental music is really big here.
Before I was a performer, all I did was go out. Every night of the week, I would be at some sort of, you know, event or function happening, whatever. And then once I started performing, even if my favorite artists were playing the same night as I was, I just didn't have the same interest. It was more focused on what I was going to be doing. And so honestly, 99.9% of what happens in this town now, I'm completely unaware of. You know, we catch a few little things here and there. The things that I'm most interested in are the people that are playing contemporary Latin electronic music in the city. So like there's a party called Gran Ritmos, and I support everything that they do. Michael Bruce and DJ Costa C are the people behind that. They're great. So
when do they play at?
Gran Ritmos is now occasionally at Holocene. They'll kind of get a big artist and do a show, you know, every couple months or so, something like that. But so things like that are what I support in this city. Daniela Carina is another DJ. There's a young DJ starting out called DJ Panaflex. So just in terms of my own personal interests, in terms of what's going to motivate me to get out to a club, it's going to be some sort of hard-hitting international music, and often Latin music is what's going to get me out.
International music.
Well, in a similar vein, but on the live music a version. Like, I love Shervona. And then we just went to see Orchestra Pacifico Tropical last week. And they're going to be playing our New Year's Eve party. Fingers crossed that happens. But yeah, like, I think...
Isn't that how it started, with a New Year's Eve party?
That was our professional debut, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a woman named Chantel Hilton. There's still a woman named Chantel Hilton, but back at the time she was booking at a club called the Medicine Hat that was on like 19th in Alberta. And I was doing house party type stuff, like I said earlier, and my roommate knew Chantel from back in the day and happened to go to this club called the Medicine Hat, maybe even just a few weeks before New Year's, and started talking to Chantel. And she's like, oh, yeah, I booked this place. And he's like, oh, what are you doing for New Year's? And she's like, oh, actually, something fell through. We had the night available. And so we stepped up to the plate, threw a sold out, crazy, crazy dance party there New Year's Eve 2000. And that really got the ball rolling.
Yeah.
Now, you've opened for some big acts, Skrillex, DJ Shadow. Do you have any comment on any of these talented artists that you've...
DJ Spooky, maybe.
DJ Spooky?
Yeah, yeah. We've never opened for Shadow.
No.
Opening up for DJ Spooky was amazing. That was at the Roseland years ago when there was Music Fest Northwest. And I think I was the opener. Maybe you were the opener.
No, because I remember the equipment was all messing up. And so I had this horrible, horrible performance where I tried to figure out what was going wrong with all the equipment. And by the time Anjali got on, everything was sorted out and she sounded great. And I was like, all right, well, I took one for the team there.
But then when Paul Miller, DJ Spooky, came out, I kind of snuck off the stage. And he called me back up. He was like, she was just amazing. Can you guys give it up for her? And I was like, whoa, that's so cool that he even heard my set and then that he liked it on top of that.
And it's rare that a headliner will call any attention to the opening artist.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's more about like trying to convince them you're the only thing that exists while you're on stage. You know?
Have you ever found yourself like just in awe of the main performer and just very inspired by them?
Well, this is the thing. So earlier, all I used to do was go to performances. I was always a spectator. It was always, you know, either a DJ or a band or whatever I was watching. And I was always blown away and I was always inspired, but it always felt like there was a piece missing. Like, you know, it's so one-sided. I'm always just receiving and receiving and I'm always the spectator. Yeah. And as transcendental as these experiences feel, they feel limited in a sense as well. And once I started performing, especially when I shared a stage, like, you know, there'd be artists that I would, you know, go see all the time before I was a performer. But once I was a performer and I shared a stage with them, they would like come way down in my estimation. Like, there's something about being on the stage and you're like, oh, they're just someone on stage too. Like, it's rare that there'll be someone where I'll be like, oh, you're really pushing this somewhere. You know?
That's an interesting phenomenon. You know, you feel like you're at that level and, you know, it's...
I wouldn't say at all that I'm on the same level as anyone that I'm ever sharing a stage with, but it humanizes a performer in a way where you're like, oh, they're just getting up here and standing in front of this equipment as well. Not as the idol worship kind of disappears.
Right. That's a great way of putting it.
When we played Sasquatch, we like opened up the night at the dance tent that Glitch Mob played. Same thing. You know, they have this like really kind of serious, like very cool exterior, like on stage, like we're the shit. In the green room, they were the sweetest dudes ever, you know? But you know who impresses me is Tribe Called Red.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, they come out and they do their thing, and that's amazing. But then the last time we opened up for them, they now have a dancer with them. And it's so unfortunate because in the electronic world, like, usually the DJ's a dude and usually the dancer's a woman. Yeah. And we are sometimes, that's kind of sometimes the version of Anjali and the Kid we do when we play festivals. Like, Steven will be the DJ and I'm the dancer. And we're not forced into that role, but it gets people more excited when I jump around to Bhangra, you know? So we found ourselves in that scenario. But A Tribe Called Red, their dancer's a guy, and he's doing his, like, tribal dance. And I so appreciate that it's like, hey, we're not putting a woman in, like, go-go boots and booty shorts on stage. We're actually, like, putting something out there that's substantial and relevant and like culturally significant, and you know, his all his hoops are like glow in the dark, so it's still clubby, you know. I you don't usually see like such bold things in electronic DJ sets. You know, it's usually like we're gonna have like a belly dancer and it's gonna be very much eye candy and for the male gaze, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah, the Tribe Called Red are so not just pushing things musically, but then visually, and then they also actually have their visuals. Like, one of the three dudes is actually just doing
maybe
remixing visuals.
Too.
Yeah, it's so, and a lot of their shows are all ages too, which is very, you know, it's so important.
And you've got a New Year's Eve party you're planning already.
Well,
is this going to be a big deal?
As soon as the last New Year's party ends, we're already thinking about it. Like, the next week, we're like, so what are we going to do different? What are we going to do the same? So, yeah, we're going to be at the Melody Ballroom again this year, and it's going to be another two-floor party. And last year was the first time we did a two-floor party. We'd always had a one-stage party. But we've been really into our Tropical concept, which is our Desi Latino Sound Clash, which we've been doing for more than 3 years now. And so last year we were like, we'd been throwing kind of almost exclusively South Asian New Year's parties. And we were like, we want to open it up more to this Desi Latino Sound Clash vibe. So we're going to be at the Melody again. It's going to be a two-floor party again, and we're just kind of putting the pieces together. But
I'm getting excited just hearing you talk about it.
Looking forward to a really good time, and definitely a very different vibe than people expect when they think of Portland and what Portland might do on a New Year's Eve.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Portland, when most people think of Portland, they probably think of white indie rockers. That's probably like you know, the biggest cultural group in Portland.
Skinny jeans.
that's not our party. And then there's the hippie subculture, and that's not our party. And there's the burner subculture, and that's not our party.
Yes.
We've been able to survive in Portland for a really long time without having a central audience drawn from any of the main tribes in Portland. Yeah. We just get scattered individuals that kind of come together. And those individuals tend to be very diverse, both in terms of age and ethnic background and country of origin and whatnot. And so our parties look and feel very different than, you know, most nights when you go out in Portland and see a Portland crowd.
That's how you describe the audience, very diverse.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, wow.
I mean, absolutely. That's always been one of our things. Like, we don't have a lot of kids that are interested in this. There's some kids that are under 21, but it seems that it takes a little bit more years before people are like, I want to try something really, really different that's not in English, that I don't understand, that's potentially operating with rhythms I've never heard before, even though they've been around for hundreds or thousands of years.
Yes.
And so, yeah, we're always drawing a very eclectic group of people that, you know, are from the kind of the margins of, you know, whatever their scene is. And we love that. I mean, because I was so attracted to a lot of international music, despite having no connections to those cultures at all, just as somebody outside the culture appreciating this amazing music that I'm hearing. And so I could never throw a party that was an insider party. But at the same time, I don't want a party that's all people from outside of the culture. I love the mix where you get people that are coming from the inside of the culture that know the music and the songs backwards and forwards, and then people that are hearing it for the first time. And so you get, you know, like, for instance, we, you know, just did our Andaz night on Saturday, and it was a, you know, super diverse crowd with people that were intimately familiar with the
analog
music at the Analog every last Saturday. And there are people there that knew all the songs, that, you know, were fluent in the languages that were being played, and then other people that had never even been in the door before, you know. And so you can get the excitement of the people that are like, I've never heard anything like this, along with the people that are excited because they're playing the favorite song and they're singing along to it. And so it's just bringing those different vibes together.
Yeah, and the Analog does attract quite a different crowd. I'm really quite familiar with that venue. I know a lot of belly dancers that love what you play.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I love the idea of a diverse crowd, and I think Portland is very open to your music. I know when I attended, my goodness, it was a party. A party is the right word. You throw a party. I don't need to keep using that word, and it really is appropriate.
That's what it is.
I think we don't really put on a show. We just like to provide the backdrop for a good party. And we like people to come up and perform on our stage is essentially what it is. And we call them the peacocks, you know, all the, like, you know, South Asian dudes and the women and all of them. I mean, white kids included. Like, everybody comes up and has their moment on the stage and has a little performance. That's exactly how we want it.
How has social media helped perpetuate this group? Do you like social media? Is it a necessary evil? Is it,
I
you know, Twitter is kind of annoying. You have to update it every day to remain relevant on this thing.
way more than once a day. What do you mean?
On Twitter, I gave up.
Social media is, I think it's absolutely a necessary evil at this point. If you're trying to throw parties, if you're trying to be a club promoter, if you're trying to be a DJ, you could try to be the most obscure person ever that plays to nobody at a club where nobody comes up. But so much of what makes DJing worthwhile is the energy that the crowd brings to it. And so you can never really have enough. Like, the more people, the more excited, the better. So you're never really reaching a point where, I suppose there's somebody somewhere that, you know, has a club that only fits 50 people and 400 line up, and they're like, oh, too many people. But the reality is you're usually always wanting more people, more energy, more people, more energy. And so, yeah, that social media presence is really, really important.
But we haven't given up on the traditional poster run. That's
old school and new school together.
Yes, exactly. We're still committed to the printing of the paper products. Sad for the trees, but... Yeah.
You know, whenever I think of flyers in this city, I think of Noah Mickens walking around in his clown suit, or if he's not in his clown suit, he looks like a homeless guy. But he cannot miss this guy. He's this big, lanky guy just running around like a madman with all these stickers and posters and flyers.
We hired his group for last New Year's to help us poster. Absolutely. Because, yeah, we do so much of our own postering, and I'll see the Wanderlust Circus stuff everywhere. Yeah, we're also about productions. And so I'll see the Wanderlust stuff everywhere and realize, like, these guys are doing the work. And when I don't have time to do it, I know who to hire.
Well, that used to be us. We used to put up all our own posters, and then we got old and gave up. That's hard work.
We used to do plenty, but we don't do all of it.
Back in the day, that was us, like, 3-4 nights a week. We just always had the supplies in the trunk, like, okay, that's what we're doing tonight.
Yeah. Boy, time does fly by, doesn't it?
Social media, yeah.
Yeah. But I do love the pictures you posted, the people dancing, and, boy, they're in really strange positions.
There's no end
like
of the
Kama
creativity.
Sutra.
There's no end of the creativity involved.
I don't even know what photos you're talking about.
You got some of the stuff on Twitter.
Okay. If you say so.
Well, You have won awards. Well, I'm a wink.
Won one award.
Yeah, this year, for the first time in 16 years, we were nominated for Best DJ in Portland, which was highly entertaining to us because we've never even been nominated in 16 years and didn't even know until someone at the Goodfoot was like, hey, do you guys know you were nominated? So we put it up like, oh, hey, if you guys want to vote for us, like, whatever. And I honestly did not want to win because, you know, I spent a lot of time on DJ forums online and stuff, and I know how many different definitions of what a DJ is there are and how contentious those definitions are and how invested people get and who's a real DJ and who's not and whatnot. And so I thought, I don't want to win. Like, you can give me second place or third place, but if you win, you got a target on your back, and everybody that's better than you or sees themselves as better than you in one area or another of DJing is then, like, neither of us are scratch DJs. Yes. So if you're a scratch DJ, you're instantly like, they're not better than me, I'm a scratch DJ or whatever. And so I didn't want to win, and I opened the paper and I was like, we won? Like, they got...
I was totally into it just because I wanted to impress my mom. Like, look, I did something with my life. And my mom thought it was pretty cool. My dad really couldn't give a shit. But
don't you live on a farm?
I kind of grew up on a farm. Yeah. I mean, I did spend a lot of my childhood on different farms. Yeah. I think my dad's like, you don't make any money. I'm not impressed.
Did anyone pay you for that? Did you get any gigs from that? No, the answer is no. We got zero gigs from that. But you can hire us any day.
Well, the Oregonian, the Portland Mercury, and the Willamette Week have all raves. So you've got that going for you. You've got really good press going on.
If there was a way to turn press into gigs, that would be amazing. I mean, one thing that we've always lacked is the manager or booking agent or person that gets us and can represent us to other people outside of the Portland area. Yeah. We've never had somebody that's been able to represent us outside of this town, so it's always us cold calling, you know, or getting calls, but we don't have the person that's like, we just lined you up those 15 gigs and you're hitting the road tomorrow kind of thing. And every once in a while we'll meet someone who think, oh, this is the person that's going to, you know, hook us up and take our press, you know, impressive press packet and actually get us some gigs with it, and it just doesn't happen.
We're all depressed.
Exactly. Steven's a type 6.
Type 6.
The Enneagram test, have you tried that? No.
I analyze everything for any possible, you know, I'm looking for the flaws constantly in any situation. I'm complaining about everything. I'm looking at all the things that are wrong or all the things that aren't quite right.
Yeah, practically the Pollyanna. Like, it's going to be all great.
Yes. We are diametrically opposed astrological opposites.
You know what? You have managed to buy a home.
This is true. This is true. I didn't think it was ever going to be possible. And
as musicians.
It all comes down to her.
Well, you asked me about growing up on a farm. I moved around a lot as a kid. Like, every year I was in a different school. I was always kind of the new kid. Every September I was the new kid. I grew up all over the Willamette Valley, lived in Tucson, lived in Philadelphia, then came back to Oregon when I was 16.
Right.
And I think because I didn't have, like, the family home, that was really important to me. Like, so I saved all those Fez paychecks from back in the day. And, yeah, Stephen really was not interested in being a homeowner. But for me, I was like, I didn't have that as a kid.
I can't think a day in the future. A day in the future is a little bit too far for me.
But, yeah, for me, I didn't have that as a kid. Like, he maybe lived in a couple family homes. His parents still live in his, like, childhood Portland home. So for me, it was, like, really, really important. And so I saved and saved and saved. And then after the crash in 2008,
Perfect timing.
We bought this place in 2009.
And it's very cute. Very nice. So.
We owe it all to Obama, who was providing $8,000 for first-time home buyers.
Yeah, I took advantage of the same deal.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
we experienced there was a once-in-a-lifetime confluence of things that came together, and
confluence is a good word.
We couldn't have done it a few months later, actually. It was just the perfect timing for any number of different events that all came together perfectly.
Is there anything you'd like to promote really quick? Anything coming up, big events, or anything you'd like to say to Portlanders out there? Because, you know, you guys have achieved something special in this city.
Well, thanks for all the love. Thanks for supporting us, you know? I want people to know about my dance classes. That's the thing. Because, of course, we have our radio shows, but I teach dance every Tuesday and Thursday at the Viscount in Southeast Portland. Yeah, that's what I want to say. But, yeah, I want to say thanks for the love.
And, yeah, in addition to being at the Analog every last Saturday, we're at the Good Foot every month or so for our Desi Latino Sound Clash.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me here and talking to you. And you're just so nice, I mean, to speak with me like this and so frank and candid and just very humble. So it was a pleasure really to speak with you.
Thank you.
Yes, it was very nice meeting you. Thank you so much. Our pleasure, totally.